Thanks for tuning into Mysteries of the Mind, a podcast revealing the way our unconscious minds shape our lives. And now, here's your host, Dr. Michael Bader.
In 1967, psychologists Martin Seligman and Stephen Meyer conducted a famous experiment. They divided dogs into two groups. And yeah, we're talking about dogs, so be prepared to hear a little bit about animal abuse in the name of science, unfortunately. Anyway, dogs in group one were given mild electric shocks at random times, but these were shocks which the dog could end by pressing a lever. Okay, got it? Each dog in group two was paired with a group one dog. Whenever a group one dog got a shock, its paired dog in group two also got a shock of the same intensity and duration. However, the lever for the group two dogs did not stop the shock. Dogs in group one, in other words, had the power to escape an unpleasant situation by learning that they could press a lever and stop it. In other words, they had some control. For dogs in group two, however, their shocks began and ended completely at random, because the cessation of the shock was dependent entirely on the actions of the dogs to which they were paired in group one. Thus, for group two dogs, the shock was really inescapable. And you know, not yet done with torturing animals, Seligman and Meyer then did this. They put each dog in what they called a shuttle box. This was a rectangular box with two compartments separated by a very low wall. So you have to picture this now. The floor of the compartment into which a dog was first placed was then electrified, sending mild but unpleasant shocks to the dog. The dog could easily end its suffering by simply stepping over the low wall into the second compartment, which was shock-free. They found that those original dogs, remember from group one, the ones who'd learned that they could exercise some control over being shocked by pressing a lever, also quickly and easily learned to jump over the shuttle box wall to avoid the aversive shocks in the first compartment. However, and this is what constituted Seligman's discovery, the dogs from group two who had, quote, learned that there was nothing they could do to end their suffering, these dogs didn't try to jump over the shuttle box wall. Instead, they simply laid down in the electrified chamber and made no attempts to escape. Seligman hypothesized this. These dogs, he speculated, had developed a cognitive expectation, you see, that nothing they did would prevent or eliminate the shocks. The heart of the matter is this. These dogs had learned to be helpless, and their helplessness generalized to include complying with and surrendering to other aversive situations. So this is the origin of the concept of learned helplessness. Seligman and others suggested that learned helplessness might really, therefore, be seen as lying at the heart of depression. Why? Well, think about it. Depressed people believe that nothing that they do will help them feel better. Their grim expectations of the future, combined with a demeaning belief in their own lack of efficacy, contribute to the symptoms of clinical depression. We see it every day. We can see the workings of learned helplessness in people in lots of different situations. Some children, for instance, who are not helped to learn math, come to believe that nothing they can do will help them acquire this ability, and they may live their entire lives convinced that there is something intrinsically wrong with them. Or a man who's shy in social situations may, without any help, come to believe that his shyness is an intrinsic character defect that can never be overcome. And thus, this guy avoids social situations, which of course only worsens the problem. Or, for example, a woman I saw in therapy grew up in a family in which she was rarely helped. She came to feel that help wasn't there to be found, and thus she gave up asking for it, even when, as an adult, it might actually be plentiful. So if there's a general rule for people in therapy, you know, it's that they feel that the world is a fixed thing that they can't change, and as a result, they give up. And learned helplessness helps us understand this phenomenon. Experts in child development, in fact, argue. They say it's vital for parents to help their kids feel that their efforts, the kids' efforts and actions, are important, that the kid can learn, and further, to actively help them, help kids to create repeated experiences of success. But imagine now what happens with parents who, say, can't tolerate seeing their children struggle and fail. We all know such parents, right? They deprive their children of the experience of learning and of mastering something through their own efforts. The big takeaway here is that success breeds a feeling of efficacy, which then breeds further success. Successful learning is an antidote to learned helplessness. See, helplessness is such a toxic feeling, and, you know, so much of our social life, frankly, seems outside our control that I might argue learned helplessness is increasingly the norm in our society. Think about the fact that few of us really control the conditions of our work and our workplace. Or what about low voter turnout? You know, we talk about cynicism in our politics today. But what's cynicism if it's not learned helplessness? When Seligman noticed some people seem more resistant than others to developing and experiencing learned helplessness, he wondered why. Well, simple as it sounds, he found that such people were more optimistic. And he set about trying to teach optimism to people. It makes sense. He helped them think about their successes and failures in a different way. For instance, that bad things were the exception and not the rule. That remaining confident in the face of adversity had lots of advantages, and that this mode of thinking could be actively practiced. Seligman claimed great success for this treatment of his, although his results have been disputed. But whether logic and rational optimism is the cure or not, the malignant effects of learned helplessness are obvious. Believing we're powerless when there are actually opportunities for control undermines our confidence and encourages cynicism and despair. People need to have experiences in which their intentions and efforts to improve their lives are successful. Psychotherapy, frankly, I think at its best, tries to help people do just that. It helps people first understand the origins and irrational logic of their depressive beliefs, their learned helplessness, and it encourages them to behave in ways that defy their pessimistic expectations, and therefore that allow for the possibility of some experiences of success. Success then begins to breed transformation. It's clear that feeling you have little or no control over important things in your life creates depression. As a society, we have to figure out how people can become empowered in every area of their lives and thus become more immune to learned helplessness. We need to be more like the dogs in group number one and less like their poor brethren in group number two.
Thanks for listening to Mysteries of the Mind podcast. To learn more about how your unconscious mind really works, please tune in next time. And be sure to visit Dr. Bader's website at michaelbader.com.